once more under the breach, dear friend.
Let's close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode, second hour, of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And telephone number in here, 254-773-1400. And, of course, that is presuming that this is Saturday, June 9th, where you are. And because it is where we are, and if you try to call across several weeks of time, it won't work.
Yeah, it doesn't work at all.
We spent the most of the previous week in Florida at a conference listening to the wise, powerful, and wealthy discuss this, that, and the other. Among other things.
At least the powerful and wealthy. I don't know. Some of them were wise. Some of them were wise guys.
Economists tend to agree on something, and it's a pretty simple thing. If you want to know how fast the United States economy can grow over a long period of time, it's pretty simple.
Any economy.
It takes hours of work, working hours, to create wealth in our economy.
Right.
That's the fundamental basis of all wealth creation in the economy.
Working hours producing something people are willing to pay
right.
for.
Right. And so, and then we have those working hours multiplied times how many dollars of output per hour the worker does.
We call that productivity.
Well, the productivity, that level of productivity, we hope rises over time. That gives us some growth in the economy. So there's two things that give us growth in the economy. One is the number of hours worked, and number two is the productivity per hour. And since most people are working full-time now, there's only a very small percentage of people who are working part-time. When we look at the part-time numbers, it's mostly people who are working multiple part-time jobs, so they're working full-time, just at multiple jobs. We can either increase productivity or we can increase the number of people working. Well, the number of people working used to be, I remember not very long ago, we assumed that 144,000 people per month would come into the economy. And so we had to increase employment by 144,000 each month or we'd start to go backwards. Now the assumption is about 100,000 because fewer people are coming into the economy because, frankly, you have fewer people turning 18 and entering the workforce.
Fewer people turning 18 and fewer people coming to the country as immigrants
right.
to work.
And so where's the way out of this? Well, we can either increase product. Right now, if you look at those two numbers and you look at the productivity growth, which is a little over 1%, 1.24%, I think it's maybe 1.24 to 1.7%, and you look at the population growth, which isn't very much right now, the United States economy has the capability of growing over a long period of time about 1.8 to 2% a year, and that's it. If we grow faster for a period of time, we will pay for it in lower growth later. So something has to give, and there's two things that can fix this fairly easily. I say fairly easily. One, we can invest a lot of money in productivity-enhancing machinery and equipment, but we have to have a really good reason for doing that, and it can't be restricted by other things, and that's not working very well right now because the highways are clogged up and we don't have enough truck drivers. The second way we can do it is have more people entering the economy to work. That's called immigration, and we're restricting that at the same time. That tends to make us purveyors of the dismal science and say things over the next several years might head downhill at some point.
All right. This is a point. Just step away from the complexity for a moment because that eventually turns into a fairly complex situation. We used to say trivia for cocktail parties, though cocktail party is not something we see a lot of anymore. Call it any gathering where you want to impress the people around you about your knowledge of the economy or economics. This is a very easy tidbit to take with you. The GDP, the growth of the GDP of any economy is based on only two things. If you can remember these two things, you're going to sound very intelligent. Demographics and productivity. Demographics is birth rates, working age. Productivity is how many things can you make in a given time period. If you can make more than other people, the United States is, by the way, just is not something that people talk about very often. We are the most productive people on the planet. That's one of the things that, you know, when we talk about the dismal side of what we're talking about, when we're talking about Social Security and the trust fund being depleted and dipping into it and all that stuff, we are still the most productive people on the planet. because we get to keep a lot more of what we make. So demographics and productivity. We've got to grow our productivity because we're not growing our population. Our death rate is very close to our increased population rate. We kill about 100,000 people a year in the United States, killed from any kind of death, old age, highways, any of that stuff. So if 100,000 new people are coming in and 100,000 old people are leaving, we're at status quo. We've been close to that for a long time. Immigration has kept us over the top. So anybody can now do this math. How's the population growth rate? Well, it's nothing right now. The only way to grow the economy then is in productivity. We can either increase demographics by saying more people come in. We'll take for a moment the assumption that that's not possible at the moment. We are not going to be doing that for the foreseeable future. It may be after we can foresee that we'll do that. But right now, we're not doing that. And the House is talking about putting together an immigration bill. We don't know what that's going to look like. It's not foreseeable. If it comes out and it looks like it makes sense, then we may be able to increase our growth. What we've done recently, because now that I've said that, you are welcome to join in on this. Now that I've said that, demographics and productivity, our GDP is way up all of a sudden. Some of you would prefer me to say all of a sudden. Either is appropriate. Our GDP is likely to be around 3.5% for the second quarter. 3.1 to 3.7 is kind of the consensus. It's a big range, but it's all in the very good range. Very, very good growth. We haven't increased our productivity drastically. Our demographics haven't grown drastically. And people are going to say, well, then how did we get a GDP growth if you just said it's only demographics and productivity? And this goes back to your point. When we go above productivity and demographics, it's got to be temporary, and we're going to have a hangover afterwards. If you infuse a lot of money into the economy, a lot of business takes place that causes people to work more hours. That's not sustainable. If you're already working 10 hours a day, working 12 hours a day is a temporary thing only. And when you're done with it, you're going to want a break. If we don't increase the amount that can be done per hour, we just have to work more hours because there's not more people. That's the simplest way of saying what we've been saying for weeks now. This is why when we have a high growth rate above demographics and productivity, we say we're going to have a bumpy point afterwards. We can just see it coming. If you're working in a business and you have all hands on deck, and you say, we got to get this problem solved and we'll get it done in 2 months. Everybody's got to be here overtime for 2 months. If you're a good business manager, you know you're either going to have to hire people or at the end of that 2 month period, a lot of things are going to be broken in your business. Maybe just your labor force is broken because you can't work that hard for that long.
So the issue really boils down to the fact that we've been making some policy changes recently in the United States. And because we're economists, not just investment managers, we're deeply concerned about the long-term effects of these things. And maybe that's a very unpopular thing to do, but it's also unpopular when at the bottom of the market in 2009, when we were in the Great Recession, we were being very, very optimistic because
this is obviously the bottom.
This is a wonderful time to invest. It's a wonderful time because we're going to do catch up. We're going to have a faster than normal rise in the market. The economy is going to take off and go like gangbusters because it has slowed down below its normal rate. And we have this thing that is universal in physics and universal in economics called reversion to the mean. And if the mean is 1.8 to 2%, and we get up near 4% in 2018, that means at some point down the road, we got to pay it back. Now, if we were coming right out of a recession.
Yeah, that would be okay. We are reverting to the mean.
Where GDP had been 0.5% or 0.9% and had been that way for several years. And we get a policy change that enables the artificial restrictions on GDP growth to be removed. And by the way, President Kennedy did that. Ronald Reagan did that.
And Barack Obama did it. In 2010, we had a couple of quarters above a 5% GDP.
Yeah, and so we have some situations where flushing more money into the economy, lowering rates, doing a lot of things that would otherwise cause problems, don't cause problems. They just allow us to catch up to norm. Once we've gotten up to the median, we've gotten up to the mean.
Just a moment. Could you say again the presidents that did it? That just repeat what you just said.
Ronald Reagan was the first one I said.
Jimmy Carter, you said.
No, I didn't say Jimmy Carter.
John Kennedy.
John Kennedy did it. I think I said John Kennedy first. John Kennedy cut taxes, and we saw an impressive growth in the economy because we were artificially restricting the growth in the economy through high taxes.
Right.
And we were beyond the Laffer point.
Right.
Then Ronald Reagan did it again. It was a tax cut. One of the problems with Ronald Reagan now is that in 1980, when he came in and the Economic Recovery Act of 1980 kicked in, it did overspeed the economy. Yeah. Remember the real estate crisis that followed, the savings and loan crisis.
And Volcker saying we got to put ourselves into a recession to get out of the inflationary thing.
And so we got rid of a lot of problems, but we created some new ones. And then we stabilized towards the end of the Reagan administration under the Tax Reform Act of 1986. And we've considered, we went through, anytime we go through a downturn, the way out of the downturn is to stimulate the heck out of the economy.
Right.
And the longer we wait to do that, the worse it gets. On the other hand, when we're at the top of the curve, when we're expending our resources faster than we're creating them, is the time that the throttles ideally need to be pulled back a little bit, pay off the debt, and recognize that if you shove the throttles forward now, what's going to happen is something's going to break down the road.
The engine is going to break.
And if you get on the highway, you can see very obviously the thing that's happening. We're receiving reports from across the economy in the service sector, which is the biggest industry in the United States. The service, the tourists, the non-manufacturing sector is much bigger than the manufacturing sector.
A lot of software is in this same basket.
What's happening is, the people who are trying to make money in that sector are finding their profits are being restricted by the fact that they can't get deliveries of the things they want to sell. And that is becoming more and more and more restrictive on the economy. Why can't they get deliveries of the things they want to sell? Well, the trucks, there's not enough trucks and there's not enough truck drivers. And if we increase the number of truck drivers, which is the wages are going up, so that we'll see that go up.
Yeah, we'll see more truck drivers.
And we'll see all these new trucks that the trucking companies have ordered come online and start running.
We still have the same size of highways.
The problem is you've already seen it on the highways. You're starting to get traffic jams where we were on the way to Austin to early in the week last week to catch an airplane. And there were slowdowns on a 6-lane highway between here and Austin, not because of an accident, not because of construction. There just were too many vehicles on the road. We're reaching max capacity on the interstate system. The railroads are running at pretty much max capacity right now to run trains up and down the railroad tracks. So once we start hitting constraints and we can't build railroad tracks and highways fast enough, although the people in Temple think there's no way to build it fast enough, we start running into these constraints, and when that happens, we're waiting in bated breath to see that this is going to happen this time around. Economic theory says prices start up, and when the prices start up, and then the wages start up to match the prices, and then the Federal Reserve has to look out for inflation, which can destabilize the currency, and they start raising interest rates, that is the opening stages of the next recession. And we're watching this cycle unwind or whatever it does. And this is the thing that we're kind of concerned about. Now, what's going on right now? What's going to go on for the rest of this year? Almost certainly, there's no certainty in economics particularly. We're going to get amazing growth. And we haven't even talked about the stock market this week.
Yeah, that is absolutely true. We're getting what we've just said. We're warning about the long term. Before you hit the stock market, let me say something about the stock market, and that is, having said all of that, the stock market is still fairly valued. If we look at the forward-looking price-to-earnings ratio, it is right in line with long-term averages. We're not overpriced. So we're not going to see big issues in the economy for a bit, and the market is expected to call that in advance and have a dip. So it's going to be a while, I would think. The market may dip during the summer. We may have a lot of bumpiness during the summer. But if you use those as buying opportunities, that's a good idea, because the market really is fairly valued. We have had an increase in earnings. There are new expenditures into long-term growth taking place.
I would even go as far as say the market's undervalued at this point.
I would agree with that.
Interest rates and low inflation.
I would agree with that.
But let's talk about the market for a moment. The S&P 500 for the week was up, up 1.62%. And for 1 year, it's up 14.28. Year-to-date, it's up almost 3.94, almost 4%. That's good. 1.62 in a week is excellent. What caused that? The simple fact that the market is driven by perceived future earnings, not the earnings we just got through reporting. If it was, it'd be 23% higher. The market is driven up towards the end of this week by an interesting oddity. While the West Texas Intermediate crude oil price didn't move hardly at all, the Brent oil, North Sea Brent oil, jumped rather substantially. There's an $11 difference. It's up to $76 now versus like 64 something for the for West Texas Intermediate. Why? Frankly, it's the tariffs. That's an odd combination. But there's the oil demand is up, but the oil demand is largely pulling from oil outside the United States and anticipated to continue to do so. Why? Well, because of tariffs, there is a shortage of steel. And the price of steel, Jake's talked about this, has gone from around $600 per rolled steel per ton about $900. Yeah. And we've got a 50% jump in the price of steel in the United States since the tariff imposition. And that is because there's a shortage. I mean, this is what we're talking about. When there's a shortage in an economy, prices go up. That generates inflation, which generates some distortion. And so pipelines are not being built as fast as they were because the contract to build the pipeline assumed a price for steel. Now the price has gone up, so there's not enough money to build the pipeline, and they're having to find more money if they're going to build it. Drillers who want to drill, want to do fracking, need a lot of steel. There's a shortage of steel. One of the bills that kind of passed under the radar said that if you're going to drill in the United States, you have to use, no, it was one of the pipelines. You have to use U.S.-made pipe, but there's not enough U.S.-made pipe in the United States to make the pipeline, so they're kind of in a hurt. So we've got an interesting situation where the price of oil is expected to go up, and the profitability in the oil and energy companies is expected to go up because oil demand outside for Brent has gone up dramatically and the price has gone up. U.S. hasn't gone up simply because we can't get it to market to sell it. Although it's expected, now that's the bad news sort of thing, it's expected that these pipelines will get built. The oil wells will get drilled, admittedly at a higher price. And it's also expected that sometime in 2018, the United States will become the largest oil producer in the world. We're waiting to see how that works out, but the organizations that represent oil drillers and producers in the United States are saying that sometime this year we will pass Russia and Saudi Arabia and become the largest oil producer
right.
in the world.
And it may have already happened. It's really hard to tell on a day-to-day. They've just increased their production a little bit. Both Saudi Arabia and Russia have increased their production a little bit. But we're increasing our production a lot right now. It's a lot. And that's the technical terminology for production increase. A lot, 0.3.
And I want to point out something here in the middle of all of our moaning and complaining about what we think are long-term threats to the United States economy and the welfare of the United States. The leading economic indicators continue to tell us the same thing. Through this year, through 2018, we are almost, not almost certainly, but very, very likely to see a very healthy economy with unusually, even unsustainably fast growth, with the markets probably, we're guessing, a rally in the late year, a very serious rally in the markets. We have seen the beginning of it now, for all we know. I personally think, given all the factors, the stock market is undervalued. It is the best game in town. There's a lot going for you if you're investing right now. Stay invested. It's a very exciting time. And also want to say, we're talking about a recession in 2020. We've talked about that a lot. It's 2020, 2021 now is the consensus that we will see probably a recession in the United States. But I want to emphasize, the recession that is likely to come in that time period is what we call a cyclical recession, not a secular recession, which means it will be relatively mild.
No one's going to label this the great anything.
It will just be, we've got too much stuff and we've hit the wall on a number of things. One of the things, if you recall, that the president promised, both presidential candidates promised, and we've done next to nothing about, is large-scale infrastructure investment. We do need to spend about $1 trillion investing in infrastructure in the United States, or we're going to run out of the ability to move the goods around the United States adequately to allow for the economy to grow. And what we've seen is, we haven't seen that. What we've seen is the government has cut taxes, which means it has less revenue to invest in infrastructure, and it's increased defense spending, which admittedly we think probably is a necessity to maintain stability around the world. But what we're not seeing is a lot of investment in infrastructure. Infrastructure investment doesn't get you a lot of votes, and anybody in Temple can tell you right now, infrastructure improvement is preceded by infrastructure destruction through town, and it is putting, there's a lot of boarded up businesses along I-35 right now that are for sale because the people can't get there. Having been in Salado for the 7 years that Salado was basically locked out of the system by the highway destruction, I can tell you that is intrinsically painful, and it causes votes to go away, which means that it's not real popular to improve infrastructure. But if we want to have good growth into the future, that's one of the prices we have to pay. We have to say we need more highways, we need more railroads, we need the bridges working and wide enough to cover what needs to be done. And if we don't get that, then we'll hit the wall on growth somewhere down the road. But meanwhile, in the short term, we're running on all cylinders. Everything is really, really pleasant. It's really exciting, and it's a good time to invest. There are, as far as I can tell, no bubbles out there. Yeah, bond prices are a little high.
Bitcoin's high.
Well, Bitcoin is such a tiny thing in the total economy that it's really hard to count. I mean, it's down 70% from its high, so it's...
People have asked me if I think that real estate's in a bubble right now because we're seeing this recovery. No, it's not a bubble. It may be a little bit overpriced. Let me say
that.
It may not be.
Given the shortage of labor,
that's the point.
Yeah.
If we get a big influx of new technology in building houses, then we should see a downturn in the prices. It's not happening. It's going to be a while. So right now, I don't see it as a bubble. I see it as a slight overpriced, or at least fairly priced based on history. If we do a straight line for a 40-year period, we're right where we should be. If we look at it based on the recovery from 2008, we may be a little low still. So I don't see it as high.
For whatever it's worth, I would not be at all surprised, and I'm not making a forecast here, but I would not be at all surprised to see the Standard Poor's 500 stock index over 3,000 by the end of the year. Now, does that mean it's going to absolutely do it? No, there's too many unknowns for me to factor.
But it wouldn't be surprising at all to me. When we look at the new earnings that have just come in based on the tax cut, and we're going to see more because those businesses are beginning to spend on new equipment. Now, here's the big ringer. Here's the big why we might not see it. If that capital spending in businesses, buying new equipment, buying big new machines so that people can do things better, slows down because of trade issues, then we could see some problems there. But there's enough money in the system right now that even if the trade issues raise the prices, I still expect to see a lot of spending going on because there's a lot of money on hand. One area, just to let you know where I see things as undervalued, it would be smaller companies, smaller cap companies. Mid-cap companies are undervalued, and that's because the majority of their trade is not international. They may build things out of internationally acquired equipment, but with, again, that extra money in the system, they should be doing really well. That's my statement on where we are right now.
Well, I think we have to do some commercials, and it's about a good time to do that.
Okay.
Don't you think?
I believe it is. We're right at the half-hour mark, or right after it.
And so, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and that's Jake over there, and this is Jeff McClure. And if you'd like to give us a call in here and ask a question or make a comment about anything we've been talking about or haven't been talking about that has to do with the economy or investing or so on, we certainly welcome your call. 254-773-1400 is the number. And we'll be back after these important words from KTEM and Town Square Media sponsors. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And if today is the 9th of June, Saturday, where you are, then you're welcome to give us a call at 254-773-1400 and talk about anything, ask about anything that has to do with the economy or anything else. By the way, it's a good time to be living in the United States. The European Union, it looks like it may, there's certainly weaknesses are showing up around the edges of the European Union. And as they thought they were emerging from finally crawling out, no longer needing economic stimulus, and they were getting ready to be fully recovered from the Great Recession, are slipping back. They may get as low as 0.5% growth this year.
Right. Parts of the European Union have been in three recessions during the Great Recession. They come out and go back down. They come out and go back down. And they haven't fully pulled themselves out of it yet.
Yeah, and even emerging markets, which, by the way, are relatively cheap, at least the stocks in the emerging markets, as a diversified emerging markets, are having some difficulties. You know, the Brazilian stock market dropped 5% this week. G7 got together and decided they were going to be the G6 and be exclude from their final statement the United States, because the United States decided to run its policy all by itself.
Well, there's another piece of it. The president said to them, why should we be part of this final statement? I don't want to be part of the final statement. And then they said, oh, fine, then you're not part of the final statement. So it's maybe that next year we won't be invited. It may be a G6. Do we need to be invited?
And then Mexico announced that they'd be placing tariffs on $3 billion worth of U.S. goods if the United States goes through. Canada has already announced that they'll be hitting us with billions of dollars of tariffs. The European Union is hitting us with billions of dollars worth of tariffs in response to our tariffs.
China is hitting us with tariffs. South Korea is hitting us with tariffs. And basically, the world is hitting us with tariffs.
And all this happened this week, and the market was up 1.62%. And really what it boils down to is things are going very, very well in the United States, and the rest of the world is where things are not going as well. And you should be very, very happy to be in America and to be cruising along in the way we're cruising along. We have a lot of potential problems. We also have a wonderful opportunity to do something about each and every one of those problems. Now, whether we will or not, there's the big question. For instance, we can fix the Social Security problem now. We can fix the Medicare problem now.
We can begin to fix the debt problem now.
We have lots of options to fix things now.
Whether we do it or not, that's the question.
I frankly think we won't. I think we're going to need some kind of crisis to do it.
That's historically accurate. But we tend to wait till we run into a wall before we turn the lights on.
But in Europe, very frankly, they are beyond the point where they can fix their Social Security crisis. They have got too few people in Europe, and the ones that are there are getting older. they don't have to worry about building up their infrastructure because their business is just not growing that fast.
They're using
because
less,
they're getting older.
Less of it. Yeah, this is something during our trip and our off time during the conferences. We did come back to the hotel after the conferences, and I showed Old Baldy here a series of videos on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
Videos of, it's called Airsoft, where people are running around shooting at each other with plastic BBs. It's a lot of fun. They're having a great deal of fun. It's maybe more fun to watch than to do at this point in our lives, but we do enjoy watching it. It was fun. But it's taking place in Europe in large part, and they have these very elaborate fields that they're playing on with castles on them and tunnels and big warehouses and huge pieces of infrastructure. And the reason is because they are young people, and there aren't that many young people in Europe. So the young people of Europe are experiencing this great benefit of the older people allowing them to have these big open spaces because there's nobody left to live there.
And one of the series where they played a series of these airsoft games was in a prison in Holland because they're abandoning prisons in Holland because they simply don't have enough crime going on in Holland. Why is that?
Well, because the people are older, when they get old enough, they get lazy. They don't want to go hold up a liquor store.
and so there is some advantage to have an aging population. You do have crime rates fall off very nicely.
Yeah.
And there's a disadvantage to having a young population in that young people are the ones who tend to commit more crimes. And
yeah, if you give them an airsoft rifle and have them shoot each other that way, they're less likely to beat each other up in hooliganism or whatever.
By the way, one of the issues that came up during the conference it was just kind of a side note that passed by, but it struck me. In the United States, we have the highest incarceration rate in the world, bar none. We have a very significant portion of our population in prison.
Rate, the next one down from us is Nigeria, followed by Russia. And we're still per capita double Nigeria.
What do they say, the number of people with a felony on their record someplace or an arrest on their record someplace is something like 20% of the population.
Yeah, and that's a problem for the labor force because we certainly can't hire them at that point.
Yeah, we can't hire somebody who's been convicted of a felony, and in many cases a couple of misdemeanors will put you out the door too just because of a liability issue. And for whatever reason, and that's one of those things where some discussion might be worthwhile, we do have a conviction rate and an imprisonment rate in the United States that's multiples of what anybody else in the world has. And that is one of the reasons our labor force participation rate is relatively low, is because once a person has a felony on their record, there's just a lot of places they can't work. And you could throw that in. By the way, there is I read the other day a high level of correlation between the opioid epidemic and felony convictions.
Yeah, that's about 43% are nonviolent offenders, mostly drug 43, possession.
43% of what?
Of the prison population.
So, by the way, these are things that you don't go to prison for in Europe, and as a result,
it makes them look like they have really, really great statistics, but
it's just one of those things that, as a nation, as a society, we need to really consider why we put people in prison. And there's a significant number of people in the United States today who can't get a job because they have had a felony marijuana conviction, and they can't get a good job anywhere. And in many states now, what they did then that got them a felony conviction is now legal. It's still illegal at the federal level, although there's a bill been introduced in Congress to get the federal government out of the business of figuring out whether marijuana should be legal or illegal, and
right,
leave it to the states, which I think is appropriate.
I just gave you the statistics for overall, but let me give you the federal prison statistic. 51.8% of the prison population, the most serious offense was drug possession. So does that mean that they are allowed they should be allowed to go break the law? No, but if we are, this goes back to my libertarian roots, if they're doing something that won't hurt anyone else and maybe won't hurt them, because it doesn't break down what drug possession it was, but anecdotally we know that the most common of the drug possession charges is for marijuana. If we look at that and we see in Colorado, it doesn't seem to be a problem, and in Oregon, and then you go through the list of places that it doesn't seem to be a problem, we don't see them trying to get a fix, and so going and robbing from their friends and neighbors so they can feed their marijuana. Now, methamphetamines, yes, that's a different issue. Heroin, that's a different issue. But we're incarcerating a lot of people and putting a pretty good, it's kind of like an engine brake on our economic engine, that we are pulling people out of the system at the time that we need them. The reality is that if somebody's smoked pot two nights ago and they show up at a construction job today, they shouldn't be kicked off the site, except we say that they should. So there needs to be some revision to the laws here. Otherwise, we are going to continue to ratchet down on our economy. It's that 85th percentile again. If and this is pretty funny, because 90% of the United States now believe that marijuana should be legal for medical purposes. 90%. And that's a statement that Congress has heard. So this week, the Senate has introduced a bipartisan bill that the president looks like he's going to sign, saying that it should be up to the states to determine whether or not marijuana is illegal. I agree with that. It's states' rights issues, from my opinion.
U.S. crude output in the United States hit nearly 10.5 million barrels a day in May. I don't know if you knew that or not. That's a record.
Wow.
It is something that Saudi Arabia would have been proud of not very long ago, and is pretty clearly pushing us quickly ahead to become the world's largest oil producer. And I mentioned earlier the net worth of American households has hit $100 trillion. There's an oddity here. By the way, that is tends to be, well, I was looking at where the focus was. The focus is not in the 1%. The focus is in older people. The older you are, the more likely you are to have more wealth, which makes perfectly good sense.
Yeah, you've been around longer. You've had more time to let things stick to you.
And it also reflects the fact that the price of housing is going up. People once again are seeing the values of their houses go up, and that is, in many cases, the largest source of wealth that's sitting there for them.
It's a very, very good time to be alive in the United States.
And, you know, we talk about the threats to the future, and I want to come back, and I said this earlier, but I think it's important to repeat it. During the really, really good times is when we start worrying about what's to come. Because when the good times are better than they can be sustained, the thing we need to be concerned about is what is going to cause the next downturn, when's it going to come, and how bad is it going to be? And most importantly, what can we do, what can a person do, or we do, in a portfolio to anticipate that downturn without losing the gains of the current upturn? I mean, you can obviously put everything in T-bills or in CDs, and you won't have to worry about upturns and downturns. You'll also very gradually lose buying power over a long period of time, because perfectly safe short-term treasuries and certificates of deposit over history have been very, very consistent. They run slightly below inflation. And inflation is eating the value away faster than the interest rate is giving you value, because you're not taking any risk. And as soon as you take measured, careful risk and you do it correctly, you don't go crazy and get stuff that has high risk, then you're in a position where you have the ability to get ahead of the power curve. And what we want to do, and that means that your prices of your whatever it is you're invested in are going to go up and down with the market value of whatever you're invested in. And the issue there is to create a type of diversity that enables whoever is holding the portfolio, whoever wants to use the portfolio for retirement or whatever, to be able to continue to hold the portfolio safely through the next downturn. And that's one of those things that at this point we're kind of odd. We're not talking about what's going to happen tomorrow or the next quarter. We do. I don't even want to make a guess at what's going to happen in the next quarter, although I think it's going to be good. The issue is what's going to happen over the next decade, what's going to happen over the next 20 years to us. And we like people to be aware, and we'd love to see some policy changes that would make things better over that long period of time.
And we may see them.
Unfortunately, we tend to be the only people who in the United States who seem to be looking 10 years in the future.
Right. This is a danger. One of the reasons why we were very excited when Paul Ryan was elected Speaker of the House is, it, you know, love him or hate him, what he did before he was Speaker was he was one of the few representatives to introduce bills having to do with the reform of Social Security and Medicare. And those are huge issues looking down the road. We've got to do something. We're at the six-year mark for Medicare. That is an issue that when it gets to it, I don't want Congress to be in panic mode. That tends to be when they get things done. It seems like they recognize internally that they get things done most easily in panic mode. That's why they give themselves these absurd deadlines and say, we've got to have this as such and such solved by this date or everything shuts down. But I sure wish we had the ability as constituents to very clearly state to our representatives, and we do, we're just not doing it, state to them, we've got to get this stuff fixed. Immigration's important. So you guys have been talking about doing that for a long time. Do it. Even if it means that you get to a log jam and you can't move forward, be introducing ideas. I want to see that happening. And when it comes to Social Security and Medicare, they're not even, I mean, with immigration, at least they're doing something, even if the something is designed never to pass. They're not even introducing the concepts for these bills right now. And these are vital for our structure. How do we move forward if we're not planning? If you're a business owner and you are about to buy a building, that by definition is a long-term purchase. You're looking ahead saying, I better have profitability in 5 years or I'm not going to pay for this building.
Well,
Congress needs to do the same.
You know, it was interesting. Press release by the Department of Labor, and I'll read it to you. It says this week, news release, for the first time on record, the number of American job openings exceeds the number of job seekers, providing the latest indicator of continued job growth and economic strength under President Donald J. Trump. And it goes on giving President Trump the credit for all of this, but this is the point. If I'm trying to expand my business, and I know, and this is in there, that there are the Department of Labor's Bureau of Labor Statistics says that there's 6.7 million job openings in the United States, but only 6.3 million people looking for jobs. And obviously there's a mismatch because many of those jobs, either the 6.3 million don't want to do them or are incapable of doing them. And I'm in a business, and I want to grow my business, and we are actually in that position. And we look out in there and say, I can't grow my business because I can't find a qualified worker. And at the same time, we have a policy that says, let's restrict immigration. Let's not have qualified people coming into the United States. Let's not have laborers coming into the United States. And you may agree with it. You may think we do need to restrict immigration. Here's my question. How do we grow the economy then? And I would love to have somebody see if they can give me an answer to this. How do you grow the economy if businesses want to hire more people than there are available to hire, but we restrict the ability for people to come in from outside the United States to fill those job openings? Maybe somebody can give us a call at 773-1400. I don't know the answer to that question. You can say, well, invest a lot in robotics, but the point is,
or any other cases, form, it's not just robotics. I mean, we're talking about a service sector being a big part of this. Invest a lot in programming to get better software so that your people can do more with the software. The problem is we don't have enough programmers.
That's where a lot of the job openings are, by the way, in programming, to the point that we had people talking about the fact that they're starting up schools for people who are out of work or who are in lower-paying jobs, because one in three people is a natural programmer. We don't know who they are, but you put them in there without any other education, and they can start writing code. And then there's a critical shortage of code writers.
A critical shortage of engineers. These are the people that would design the robots.
Yeah, those are expensive and take a long time to build.
Right. That's not something we can come up with a lot of engineers quickly, and this is key.
Well, we're actually getting rid of a lot of engineers.
Yeah, that's the key, is that 60%+ of the grad students in engineering come from other countries.
And
this is more than the 50+ right, percent of normal grad students. Engineering is disproportionately from foreign students in the United States, and we're telling them to leave when they're done,
right,
while we have a massive shortage of engineers.
We're not just telling them to leave. We're forcing them. People who have a master's degree in engineering would like to stay in the United States and fill some of these empty slots so that we can catch up. And we have a national policy right now that says, no, do not stay in the United States and be an engineer. Get the heck out of Dodge.
This doesn't make common sense. If you look at it from a common perspective, if they were here stealing a job, if they were saying there's an American that's equally qualified to do this job that doesn't have a job, this is an oxymoron if you want to hear one, unemployed engineer. You don't see unemployed engineers. Unless they've built something that collapsed on someone.
Either kind of engineers, either ones who drive trains or the ones
Right. And the same is true with software engineer. So if you're looking at this from our perspective, which is, yes, I would prefer American-grown engineers. No doubt in my mind, I would prefer that. Why is that? Well, because I'm an American. But if we don't have enough to go around, then I would prefer any engineer, because the history of America is chock full of immigrant engineers causing us to be successful. If you just think of Tesla, of Watt, you just go back through the great engineers of our time, and you'll find the majority of them came from another country. So we pull people here who are the best and the brightest. Let's not send them away after we make them even better. And that's the common sense approach. I know that it doesn't hit the populist. If you think about, you know, we've had, this is one of the problems that we've had since Ronald Reagan. We haven't had immigration reform. Therefore, we've had a lot of illegal immigration. That changes the public opinion of immigration as a whole. When the majority of immigration is illegal, it causes us to look at immigration as a problem rather than as a benefit. We got to get this fixed. I don't know that it's going to happen, but I hope it does, because, I mean, this week the House of Representatives is going to actually address a bipartisan immigration bill. That's a big thing. If it addresses the Dreamers, that's kind of nice. But we need an overhaul of immigration from one end to the other to say, this is what's supposed to happen, and here's how we're going to make it so that what's supposed to happen actually happens, so that we can enforce immigration laws, so that we can track the people, and so that we can give benefits to corporations and to the public. Our standard of living goes up when our income goes up, and our income goes up if we're producing more things. And if we're producing more things, it means somebody created some method for us to do it. If the somebody is an immigrant and it made me wealthier, I'm happy. So keep that in mind. I feel like I've been on my soapbox and you've been on your soapbox. We have clean feet.
Yep, sounds good. We're getting close to out of time, but the telephone number, though, still remains 254-773-1400 in here.
Yeah, if you've been waiting to call, you've got about 2 minutes to make your question in here. If you're not waiting to call, if you're just listening to us, we appreciate the listening. If you're not listening to us, then you can't hear us insult you. Anybody that's not listening to us right now doesn't know what's good for them.
I don't know that that's true.
But they will never know about it. Unless you tell them, listeners, you might tell them that we insulted them.
You know, and we're hoping that a lot of this turns around. We haven't actually seen the true impact of the tax cuts in the economy. And I don't know, we're having trouble seeing it because the tariff threat is slowing down,
clouding the picture.
It's slowing down investment, business investment. The fact that a company wants, they've got a tax cut, they've got extra money, and they want to invest it in new equipment to become more productive so that they can export a lot of stuff outside the United States. But with the potential trade war looming where they could become overnight non-competitive because of tariffs, They're apparently being reluctant to reinvest that money, which means it's building up. Hopefully, and by the way, the consensus among the economists that we listen to, and apparently the consensus on the street, on Wall Street, is that the trade war won't happen, that President Trump will back down.
Or that we'll come to some kind of an arrangement with our allies and enemies in a way that won't lead to a trade war.
But the point is that when he says, I'm going to impose 25% steel tariffs on everybody.
How does that not happen except in a individual case, one by one? We're going to have trade issues.
But the point is that the consensus is this is just bargaining ploys and he'll pull them back. If he doesn't, the market is going to be very unhappy about that, and I would not at all expect to see a minor correction in the market if that actually occurs. Fair warning.
Yeah,
you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and we're out of time for today, June 9th. And if you'd like to contact us off the air, we do have voicemail on the weekends, live people during the week, at 254-947-1111.
You can reach that same voicemail or live people toll-free, 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, where you will find our newsletter. You can sign up there. You can hear recordings of this program going back many years. If you want to email us directly, it's jeff at tpwc.com or jake at tpwc.com.